Coaching Inside the Box,
a youth soccer coaching podcast.
A Brit,
a Brazilian,
and an American
discuss culture and environment
and the impact it has on youth development.
Can you coach inside the box?
Welcome back. It's March. We're back in the studio, eager to share some more perspective about one of our favorite training structures. But before we get there, it's worth noting that this episode is notable. Worth noting because this episode is notable for one specific reason. It's episode 17. Andy, 17. That's a pretty significant number between you and me, yeah?
Why?
He has no idea. I wore 17 in a Legends uniform for my entire youth career. You must have coached me in 500 games. You don't remember what number I wore?
I blanked it out. You were so bad. I just couldn't. I couldn't retain that
information. Maradona. Shout out for a throw-in. That was my MO in the 17 shirt. And in the 4 shirt and in the 5 shirt and every other shirt I wore after I left the club.
They say in life you forget the worst things that happen to you, so that, you know, that explains why I don't remember your number.
In Brazil, nobody cares for anybody that their jersey is higher than 11, so.
Okay, so maybe that's why I ended up with 17. Hey, it's kind of funny because it's March
17 on the roster.
It's kind of funny because it's March 17th, so St. Patrick's Day. Happy St. Patrick's Day, guys.
Oh, we got a...
Yeah, for those of you guys kind that are of watching, you'll see
we Irish
put
shirt.
Out a Shamrock Rovers FC shirt.
So you expect me to say Happy St. Patrick's Day? I'm English.
What's
I
wrong
mean,
with
the
that?
Irish and the English, and you know, I mean, they're the old enemy. You know, it's, you know, the old enemy is Scotland.
I thought you guys were all the same thing, all yeah. Britain. No?
Yeah, that's what I thought about you and Argentinians and Uruguayans and Chileans.
Never.
You know, just the same thing, you know.
I'll take everybody but the Argentinians.
I will say, as just a general observation, it hit me a few years ago when we opened Happy Feet in Ireland, is that St. Patrick's Day is like this worldwide celebration. Everybody knows it's St. Patrick's Day today, right? Like, everybody in America says they're Irish. There's 330 million people that live in the United States. There's only 4.5 million people that live in Ireland. Like, how on earth did a country of 4.5 million people literally take over the world?
Or they infiltrate bred like
the world?
Rabbits.
Apparently,
every
it.
Family was like 20 people.
If that's the case, why is there only 4.5 million there? They all left.
They're all here.
The potato famine. They lived on potatoes, and you know, potato got the blight, and but they had to leave because they died if they stayed.
Because nobody likes Ireland.
And every listener is going, I didn't realize this soccer podcast that talks about development and culture was going to spend so much time on the Irish, but we will.
Yeah, and they've got that stupid sport, Gaelic football, you know, which is why they've never been any good, really, until they got an English coach at soccer. You know,
what are you talking about, Mick McCarthy?
No,
Jack Charlton.
Big Jack.
In 94. That
the
was
man.
Jack. The man.
Two World Cups. He got them to two.
Is an English man saying that somebody's not good at soccer? One World Cup that they pay for it.
Yeah, that's right. We've won 4. We're one behind you.
England didn't really win in 1966. That ball did not go over the line. And I'm English, you know. I mean, you know, it was... What do you expect? The guy on the line that gave the goal, you know, was from where?
The linesman. Irish?
No, he was Russian. German goal, Russian linesman. No way, German goal.
I can draw this line.
No way.
Brings us all the way to current events. With that said, let's carry on into the soccer portion
history
of this discussion,
itself.
Which will hopefully be most of the discussion today. But we're talking 2v2s, and this is... a giant piece of our structure from a coaching and training perspective. It is massively important to the development of our players for a lot of reasons. We're going to dig into first defender, second defender, first attacker, second attacker, and all the various elements and layers that exist within the 2v2. But before we do, I want to mention, if you go back and listen to episode 7, which is funny, 17-7, man, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories we can go here. But episode 7, we talk at length about the genesis for the 2v2 structure within our club, right? We talk about the Man United Ghana story. Andy tells the story phenomenally. It's probably my favorite story that Andy tells. He tells a lot over and over again, but that's probably my favorite story. So go back and listen to that episode once you finish listening to this one, and it'll fill in, it'll color quite a bit of the dialogue that we're going to have today. With that said, though, let's give a quick run through on the Ghana story. Andy, 1993, you're in Manchester, England, with your 79-80 Legends team, if my memory serves.
Right.
And you find out that the U17 and U19 Ghanaian national team is there on tour, and they're playing a friendly against the Manchester United youth sides, correct?
Right. It's an exhibition friendly because it was timed to coincide with this big tournament that Manchester United sponsored.
The Umbro Football Festival.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
So tell us what you saw.
And we saw what, you know, and we were totally ignorant of what we were seeing on the Manchester United side at the moment in time that we were watching the game. We had no idea that the future would reveal that the Manchester United team was exceptional. So we're looking at a group of, you know, under 19 Manchester United players that had just won the FA Youth Cup. So we knew they were good because you don't win the FA Youth Cup unless you're better than every youth team in England, you know. But we didn't know that we were looking at incredibly good because on that team were David Beckham, Paul Scholes, the Neville brothers, Ryan Giggs, you know, Robbie Savage. The list goes on and on. The, you know, later superstars, you know, that had a huge impact on the game in the world, you know, not just in Great Britain. You know, you look at David Beckham's career, he had a huge impact on North America. You know, so, you know, what we were seeing was an incredible Manchester United side. And the Manchester United under-19s played against the Ghanaian under-17s, and they'd just come back from the World Cup. And I think they were second in 1993 in the World Cup. They won in 1991. They were second in 93. They won in 95. They were second in 97. Had a disaster in 99. They were third. You know, so the decade of the 90s, they won five. You know, sorry, they were either first, second, or third in five World Cups. So we were seeing this incredible Ghanaian youth program. You know, in 1993, and so we knew they were, you know, one of the top youth teams in the world. We knew that Manchester United was the top youth team in England. We didn't realize how good both teams were at that point in time, you know, and the Ghanaians whipped Manchester United's youth team within an inch of their lives. I think it was 4-1, but it wasn't that close. You know, they were doing things that the Manchester United players just couldn't conceptualize in terms of recognition and individual skill and combination plays. And
speed of play, I assume.
Oh, yeah, rocket-fire speed of play. You know, it was at times like the Manchester United players were chasing shadows. You know, you watch, you know, Manchester City versus Norwich these days in the EPL. You know, give you an idea of what I'm talking about. Is Manchester City absolutely dominates in terms of possession and skill and, you know, and goal scoring, you know, the lower levels of the EPL. You know, and so anyway, after the game, I literally make a beeline for their coaches and I say, are you going to be practicing while you're here? Because I need to see what these guys do in practice to be this good. You know,
and, I mean, full picture, right? Like African football hadn't come of age really in the 90s, right? This is the beginning of African football stepping onto the world stage, because in the 80s, I don't think any of the African teams did very well in the World Cup like they do these days.
Well, the World Cup at the under 17 level did not exist, I think, before, you know, maybe 1975, somewhere in that region, 1980.
Yeah. I'm just trying to paint a picture. You're there on the sideline watching the Ghanaian players just destroy Manchester United, and African football really isn't revered very highly at this point.
Oh, no, it wasn't on anybody's radar. Yeah. You know, when they won the World Cup in 1991, that was a complete shock to the system of all of these, you know, so-called, you know, traditional powers, you know, like the Germanys, the Englands, the Spains, the Italys. You know, and even to a certain extent, you know, Brazil, you know, and Argentina, you know, this was a shock to the order as it stood in that era. So I go along to the practice, and I'm a little bit late, and they're already practicing. As I walk up to the practice, I have this horrible feeling because it's something I've never seen before. It makes me feel totally out of place. Like this is wrong. I do not believe I'm seeing this. And what I saw was on one field, you know, not the whole of the field. You know, it's two squads, remember, there's like 30 players. You know, not even half the field. All the players are in one penalty area and they're going from side to side of the penalty area, not even restraining out to goal line. And they're playing multiple games of two-on-two where everybody's going at once. You know, and I had done this with one-on-ones, but I'd never seen that happen with two-on-twos. So this was a total shock to me. I just thought it was impossible, that you couldn't do it in that type of space. Too many bodies.
It looked chaotic.
No, it didn't look chaotic. It looked ridiculous. It was like ants. You know how you kick open an ant's nest and thousands of ants swarm all over the place? It looked like that. It was, you know, Grand Central Station in rush hour. You know, it looked at first glance like a complete waste of time. You know,
because with 1v1s, it's two players, one ball, there's no passing. And so the only release skill that you see is shooting. And so that's much, much less chaotic than 2v2s in a crowd.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense. And if you to look at it, you can see straight away what's going on. You know, and when I walked up to that field, I couldn't perceive straight away what was going on because I'd never seen anything so, you know, at that point in time, in my estimation, ridiculous in all my life. You know, but what as I sat there, I started to see moments of absolutely incredible beauty and, you know, complication that was successful in terms of breaking down, you know, the defense and finding a way through the crowd with, you know, the teammate and how to get by two opponents. And you're not just playing against your immediate opponent and the covering defender, you're playing against everybody else that's between you and the goal. And so the amount of input, the amount of stuff that's hitting the brain is monstrous in terms of complications, you know, and these players seem to be able to negotiate that almost effortlessly. And it was an epiphany for me, you know, and as the practice went on, you know, my jaw dropped lower and lower in amazement at the absolute beauty and yet creative efficiency that they were demonstrating under pressure. And as I thought about the game that I'd watched between the Golden Boys, the Manchester United youth team, and the Ghanaians, I thought back to that game, I realized why it made sense now, because these players were doing unbelievable things in tiny spaces right in front of goal on the dirty side of the ball as well as the creative side of the ball, and they were managing not to bump into each other, which in itself was an achievement with that many bodies in such a tiny space. It was like they had radar. In my first book, I used the analogy bats in a cave, because bats literally do have radar, you know, and they're able to fly at full speed in a crowded cave without having collisions.
So you see all this beauty, this creative efficiency, which is, I think, an excellent way of putting it, and immediately you're thinking, how do you train a player to be able to do that?
Yeah. How on earth?
Yeah.
You know, it's
what drill do you run?
You know, because that's where I go, you know, being a consummate, you know, coach, you know, trained as a phys ed teacher, you know, and having made that my life and you know, literally immersed myself in that environment, the first thing I think is, what do I have to do to get my players to play that way? So the question is, how and why? You know, how do you train? And of course, why do you train that way? What's the thought force that goes behind train in that way, and you know, hopefully having a system behind it. So I'm wondering, you know, what's the system? What's, you know, what are the how and why behind what these Ghanaian coaches are doing with these kids? Mm-hmm. So
did you go ask them?
Yeah, after the practice was over, I made a beeline for the coaches, and as soon as they were done talking to the team, I pulled them to one side and I said, you know, that was fantastic, that was fascinating. What drills did you use to teach these players how to do this? And they looked to me like, you know, I was an idiot, and said, no drills. You know, we don't have to do drills to train the players to play this way. You know, and I said, well, now you're not understanding. Now, you know, how did you set up your cones? How did you set up your practices? Because, you know, obviously, you know, you must have done something that was unusual to get the players to play this way. And they said, yeah, we did this. You know, I said, no, you're not understanding me. Come on, guys, you know. You know, there must be some methodology, you know, and they looked at me and said, we're the national team. We didn't develop these players. We're national team coaches. We just put out the word around the country that we want your best players to all the youth teams, you know, you know, all the, you know, the league clubs that were playing professionally and paying their players, we wanted all their youth players, their best youth players, to come on in so that we could pick the national team from all these youth players. But this is the way that they grew up playing the game. You know, and I stopped and I thought for a second and I said, I'm being really stupid here, aren't I? And the, you know, the Ghanaian coaches, yeah, you are. You know, they're probably thinking, you're a stupid Englishman, you know, just stick it in the mixer and, you know, and you know, let's see what comes out and hope we get a goal, you know. And they're saying, yeah, you know, we didn't develop these players. You know, they grew up playing, you know, in these small-sided games all over the country. You know, by the time we got them, they had this skill set.
The skill set to be able to navigate a crowd and be creative and come up with solutions that aren't obvious and do the extra special. This is a perfect segue into what I wanted to ask Philippe, which is, Philippe, you grew up in Brazil. I'm wearing a Brazil shirt for you today.
Actually, love it.
The only soccer jersey I had that had green, so this is my attempt to be Irish. But growing up in Brazil, the style of play that you guys had in the streets mimicked some of the 2v2 structure that we have today. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Can you paint that picture for us?
Well, it's a lot of what we do there. You know, a lot of times we only had, you know, just out and about with your friends, and there are not a lot of kids. There are just six kids. Put one on each goal and 2v2 and just play. Or, you know, 3v3, 1v1s, 2v2s, 4v4. It's always low numbers, you know. Very rarely I would be playing in bigger fields. It was always like futsal courts or, you know, just spaces that had walls around or whatever, you know, or even, you know, just us making like a lines with our flip-flops and two small goals and just playing, you know. So literally all you needed to do to play soccer back home was have one extra person and a ball and a little bit of space. So that concept is very familiar to me, you know, just having kids playing 2v2 small spaces, you know, and trying to be creative at it.
So I think the answer there to the Ghanaian success, which is unmatched from a youth perspective in the 90s with any other decade by any other youth team in the world, and Brazil, which is obviously the best soccer country historically, the answer there is that there aren't drills that train it. It's instead an environment that encourages the play.
And it's the same thing if you ask me, oh, how do the Brazilian academies, how do they train their players? Well, they teach them more of the team game, but by the time these kids get to that academy, they're so good technically, like they're so skillful. They've done this. They play this street soccer style for their whole lives. And, you know, when we're talking their whole lives, in a Brazilian kid's case, especially the kids that come from the favelas and, you know, more the poorest areas of the country, it's not 1 hour and a half twice a week, you know, in your team practice. It's 5, 6, 7 hours a day, you know, every single day for years and years. So when they get to the clubs, yeah, the clubs don't need to do those things.
Ah, but
they're already.
Is that true? Is that true? The clubs don't need to do that things because the Ghanaian national staff did those things. They just were an extension of the street soccer that those kids grew up playing, but they formalized it. You know, they did it in their practices during the national team camps, and that's something they made clear. You know,
yeah,
they didn't prepare these kids to do these wonderful things that we were seeing. They just took it to a whole different level because now those kids are doing it against kids at their own level in the national team program.
But if the status quo across the world is cones and very rigid tactical training for youth, and Brazil has all of these kids that played creatively until they got to the club, and then they started learning that stuff. If that status quo stays the same and the game doesn't advance from a creative perspective, Brazil will and Ghana will always be on top, right? Ghana, and I don't mean, obviously, Ghana's never won a World Cup, but you understand my point from a youth perspective. So the status quo stays the same. Obviously, we as coaches, and I think as a coaching community, would prefer not to have the status quo change stay the same, right? So if we're actually going to push the game further from a creative developmental perspective, that both impacts what happens between the white lines on the field, but also from a brave creative leadership life perspective, then we want to see more creativity through both the club perspective and in the natural environments that exist within specific cultures.
Yeah, but winning gets in the way.
Correct.
You know, so, you know, what typically happens is, especially more these days, because the academy concept has been brought in-house in these professional clubs, and, you know, coaches are training their kids to win at an early age now. You know, these are professional coaches in big clubs, you know, and they're missing the boat. And so, you know, I'm going to tell a little story about, you know, a really old and very good friend of mine called Paul Bolson. And, you know, we're kind of like brothers from another mother. We, you know, did a phys ed degree together in South Wales, in Britain. And, you know, Paul, you know, went the academic route, and he moved to California to take a master's degree after getting his phys ed degree. And then he moved to Sweden and to take his PhD. And he started coaching with the women's national team in Sweden, and he started applying, you know, the his perspective on small-sided games to the women's national team, which caused them to have a big uptick in both their skill and physiology, because he did everything at the same time, you know. And he's a massive believer in small-sided games to train fitness. So the amount of fitness that is done, you know, under Paul's, you know, direction, without the ball is minimal. You know, they do small-sided games, and they track, you know, heart rate, and they track, you know, the different types of, you know, pace at which people run. But of course, when they're doing small-sided games, they're also developing the skill while they're developing the physiology. But they're developing more specific physiology and skill. So, without going deep into, you know, Paul's approach and philosophy, you know, it's very, very similar to what we do, but they concentrate more on 3v3 and 4v4 because they're dealing with professional teams and professional players, but they do more of those small-sided games, I think, than just about anybody else in the world. Now, here's where it gets interesting, because the Swedish women have been a powerhouse. Swedish women have been a powerhouse, you know, ever since he got involved with their program. You know, why? You know, he still helps them to this day. Why? You know, because of the way he trains players with the ball. So, you know, whatever the girls had when they got involved in the national team program is enhanced by his approach when they're training the national team. And as a consequence, those players continue to progress under his tutelage. And so they started in working with the Swedish men's national team. And ever since he got involved, they've been punching above their weight to an incredible degree. Now, here's the interesting thing. He had the flexibility to go and start working with Bolton Wanderers when Sam Allardyce, the ex-England manager, was the coach of Bolton Wanderers. And Sam Paul turned Bolton Wanderers into, you know, a top four or five team in the EPL. From being, you know, a relatively, you know, humdrum club that didn't really achieve anything, you know, and, you know, the one of the best periods, at least the best period in Bolton's modern day history, and now they're in the doldrums again, you know, because it's been a long time since Sam and Paul were there, you know. So, but don't think it's Sam that's the key here. Paul is the key. And then he moved to Southampton, and all of a sudden Southampton starts taking off. You know, now they all, Southampton also had a guy that we trained here in the Kansas City Legends called Matt Crocker. So they had a guy that had a really, really, you know, good insight into the way the Legends Club worked, because he coached my daughter and I was in his ear for a couple of years while he was coaching my eldest daughter, Brittany. You know, and, you know, Matt Crocker went on to run the English program, and lo and behold, they won the first World Cup since 1966 with the under-17s while Matt was overseeing that program. So here we've got a thread that's happening here. And so Paul did the same at Southampton, worked his magic, and out of Southampton, you know, great players. Theo Walcott, Gareth Bale, Luke Shaw, Callum Chambers, who scored an incredible goal for Arsenal a couple of weeks ago. You know, and these players not for Arsenal, for his new club. I'm sorry, I can't remember which one it is. But these players have absolutely, and these teams, completely turned around under Paul Bolsom's tutelage. So then, and this is the best of all, Bolsom moves to Leicester City. And Leicester does the 5,000-to-1 miracle within a couple of years of Bolsom arriving, because obviously you can't wave a magic wand and change things overnight. But the thing is, they were doing all of their fitness now with ball work, you know, during the week. And so, you know, they were becoming vastly better players under pressure in the club by doing, in the clutch rather, by doing small-sided games, you know, in front of goal completely and utterly and absolutely. Now, Leicester City has been a top 4, 5, 6 team, you know, for the last 7, 8 years while Paul Bolsom has been there. He left at the start of this season. Where are Leicester City now? They're in a worse place in the EPL than they've been since before Paul Bolsom got involved. And now Paul Bolsom is with the Tigres in Mexico. He wanted a new adventure, and guess what? The Tigres are right up at the top in the Mexican league, you know, and, you know, they're doing things they haven't done for a while. And, you know, Bolsom works magic wherever he goes because he does it with small-sided games. And he's a physiological masterpiece. He's an expert. So, you know, this stuff is now, there's all sorts of proven track records to say we should not be doing rondos. It doesn't make any sense. 5 versus 2 instead of 2 versus 2 does not train a fantastic individual and team soccer player in the clutch.
I mean, the enthusiasm that coaches have to control things, right? To control a session. And if you're going to run a session that's 5 versus 2, it's easy to control and make sure that possession happens within the session, right? Whereas 2v2 is a little chaotic, a lot chaotic. And that chaos is something that's not controllable by a coach. And I think oftentimes we as adults or as coaches look to control, because then we can predict the result in an easier way. Even though it's false logic, I think that's the logic that exists to get us to that place.
Right. But here's the sad thing is that there was a whole bunch of you know, key youth coaches selected to meet with Greg Berhalter. At the Olympic Training Center here in Kansas City a couple of years ago. You know, and at the end of the presentation, I asked him one question. I said, so, you know, most of us youth coaches, you deal with adults. You know, I'm very specifically interested, Greg, in what advice you would give us and what we should be focusing on as youth coaches in order to, you know, create the players that you want to see on the U.S. national team. And he said, 5 versus 2. I didn't say anything. I couldn't say anything positive about that comment. Because 5 versus 2, you know, you've got 2.5 times the advantage in 5 versus 2. The 5 shouldn't give up the ball ever at that level, you know, against 2 defenders. You know, but that's not making the most of the 5. You know, you're not really pushing them to go to the next level. You know, you've given them such a massive advantage. When in the game do you have 5 attackers against 2 defenders? Literally never. Ever. You won't see that in any soccer game. You know, if you go thousands and thousands of minutes in across the EPL or La Liga, you know, Serie A, the Bundesliga, you will not see a defense 5 versus 2.
I think I remember seeing as a kid in the 90s an MISL game where there was a fight that broke out and one team had 3 guys
thrown out.
So it was a 5 versus 2 power play. As we transition, let's talk specifically about the structure of the 2v2 and what it looks like for us as coaches when we put these sessions on. And for those of you guys that can get access, I know everybody can get access. We did a presentation at the United Soccer Coaches Convention just in January, and I believe all of those sessions are accessible online. So go to their website, unitedsoccercoaches.org, I think, and you can access specifically this session, and you can see us as coaches running a session with our players in the 2v2, so you can actually see what it looks like. But the structure for 2v2 for us is...
Let's be honest, though. It doesn't look anything like...
That's fair.
what we do in our facilities.
Because we were using the field that they had provided us, which wasn't a wall.
And it was
field.
Huge.
And it was huge, yeah. That's
it
fair.
Was huge. It was slow. It didn't have walls. And
it's what it looked like for me as a 16-year-old playing for you when we trained outdoors without indoor facilities, because in the 90s we didn't have those.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, I didn't have the knowledge back then that I have now. And so, you know, I didn't know how important the environment was.
So I can blame you for all of my errant shots.
No. I think
not taking that monkey.
You know, that one's on your back, you know, because, you know, you didn't learn as quick as the players you were playing with.
But as we set up 2v2, so like simply put, you've got two goals. Those goals are close. You've got, you know, however many sessions you've got on. We were talking about it before we started recording. Ideally, you've got two teams training together, so you get more kids, right? And then the intensity is higher, and we can go into that in a second. But, you know, sometimes I have as few as 12. Sometimes I have as many as 24 players, and it's simultaneous games of 2v2, right? One team is playing the other team. They're going to goal. They're trying to score. They're using individual fakes and moves that we've taught them, scissors, Matthews, Cruyff, right? Or they're using combination play, wall passes, overlaps, wall pass fakes, overlap fakes to break down the opponent and put the ball in the back of the net. And then typically it's make it, take it. And so then if you put it in the back of the net, you get it and you're going the other direction. So it's fast paced. There is no time to slow down. It is a small playing area and everybody is on the same playing surface. And then we institute conditions that foster early decisions and maximize speed of play. Right, like if you were to go back and highlight when you were watching the Ghanaians train in Manchester in 93, I'm sure you would have, you know, if you wrote down five things that you were impressed by their type of play, you would have included the fact that they were making very early decisions and their speed of play was otherworldly. Would that be correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And speed of play has to be fast in a crowd when you're playing 2v2, so much quicker than 5 versus 2, right?
Because the environment creates speed of play.
Yeah.
You know, and so when it's crowded, you know, when you've got, you know, defender all over you, and there's one defender that is specifically his job to stop you when you've got the ball, you know, so he's going to be, you know, right there in your face as soon as you receive the ball, you know, so you've got that guy right in your face. And then you've got this crazy melee of bodies all around, mm-hmm. you know, so you're not just thinking about the guy in your face and you're not just thinking about his teammate and your teammate. You're thinking about where everybody else is moving simultaneously,
yeah.
you know, and you're having to take all of this information in. You know, you've literally got to be the fastest supercomputer,
yep.
you know,
yep.
and as well as being incredibly skillful on the ball. And having, you know, multiple ways to get out of pressure or beat a man.
100%. And the way in which we structure it is as kids arrive, we put them into a spreadsheet, if you will, that's everybody listed. And then we've got matrices set up, which we're willing to share with you. You just email us and we'll share it with you. Set up so that we know what every round is. But Philippe and I are going to play Andy in that light post. And we're going to play 2v2 for 2 minutes, two and a half minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it might be. And at the end of the round, the kids are going to come in and report their scores. We have two primary methods for scorekeeping on this front. For my younger kids, when I occasionally throw them 2v2 just to keep them engaged and entertained, they've done too many 1v1s in a row, and I want to make sure that practice is maximally fun. So instead of scrimmaging, I usually play 2v2s because it's more worthwhile. I don't have them do the complicated scoring system. I just have them at the end of every round tell me if they won, lost, or tied, right? And so now they're accountable to the work that they're putting on the field. They're doing all of that work. The other way in which we do scorekeeping, which is what my older kids do, and presumably I know Andy's older teams have always done, and I presume Philippe's teams do, is every player gets a point for every goal that they score in the round or assist that they make. So if I scored a goal and I made an assist, I would be +2. If my team won, I'd now be +3. But I can get minus points too. If I'm marking Philippe and Philippe scores, I'm now -1. So Philippe scored 1, I scored 1, had an assist and my team won, my total would be +2. And that's the score that I report in. And what that enables us to do as coaches is at the end of the night, at the end of the round, we've got a final tally for every single player. And we can rank them all in terms of where they fit in the 2v2 for that night. And that's fantastic for holding them accountable, for providing them trackable progress, right? To show when they're improving. Yeah, maybe they were last place, but maybe their last place was only one behind the guy that was in second to last, which was 10 better than it had been the previous, you know, 4 weeks. And so that's something to celebrate for that specific player. And so this is how the 2v2 looks. Philippe or Andy, would you add anything to very specifically, not the why behind it, but the what of our 2v2?
You can't completely separate the what from the why.
Sure.
You know, so what I wanted to point out here is that the 2v2 in a crowd scenario takes the skill continuum and more than any other exercise in the history of training for soccer, it makes the players focus on the most difficult way to score, first time finishing, and the most difficult way to retain possession, which is using moves to beat an opponent to create penetration, to break that line. You know, and one of the key rationales for using two versus two is when you are doing the most difficult thing, first time shooting, and you're doing that to a much greater degree than other coaches who are training other teams that you compete against, you know, you're not just learning first time finishing, for example, you're not just learning how to do moves and beat an opponent, you know, and those two are on the opposite end of the skill continuum because one is a release skill and one is a maintenance of possession skill. You know, so you're trying to keep the ball in one extreme and you're trying to put the ball in the back of the net in the other extreme. But you are learning everything between those two skills. So if you've got an ability to shoot first time and score, you know, then shooting after taking a touch is many times easier. Following me? Shooting after, you know, a dribble is many times easier because you're setting it up on the dribble. That's even easier than shooting off of the second touch, because you've taken multiple touches to get the ball in position for the finish, you know, and go to the other end of the skill continuum. Deceptive dribbling is many times easier than dribbling, you know, around without trying to penetrate, than dribbling in a straight line. You know, so you're doing the most difficult thing in deceptive dribbling. You know, you're setting up this David Copperfield magic trick with the ball to beat a player to create penetration before you shoot. And so using the phys ed principle of transfer of training, which dictates that the harder skill that is related to the easier skill transfers into you learning the easier skills while you are learning the harder skills, what we're learning is everything at once. So this isn't a 2-for-1, this is even a 10-for-1. This is like 100-for-1 because you're learning everything in the game at once that you're going to need under pressure in the most intensely crowded areas of the game, right in front of the opponent's goal or right in front of your goal, on the dirty side of the ball as well as the creative side of the ball. So why on earth would you do functional training, you know, with a player just, you know, knocking a ball 50 yards down the line when you can do really, really functional training by putting everybody in this crowd in front of goal, defending and attacking in a 2-on-2? Does all that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Philippe, I want to bring you into this conversation. So you've got a very good 2009 boys team, right? And 2v2s is a pretty significant piece of their training regimen or their training diet, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do they think of it?
They love it. They hate one-on-ones, but they love 2v2s. I don't know. I feel like the fact that you get to work with somebody else, it's always more fun. You know, you get to, you and your teammate joining forces against somebody else, you know, you get to cheer for your teammate when he gets the ball, when he's trying to do something. And, you know, when I'm having the ball, then my teammate is doing that. When I mess up, my teammate has my back. And when he messes up, I have his back. I feel like that also, that element of the 2v2 is also very important for the chemistry of the team, and it's what happens on the weekend. I think it builds friendship. Sometimes I like to change a little bit the matrix and make sure kids play together more, because maybe they will be in similar positions, you know, center back with the left back on the same side, you know, just to build more, even more chemistry between those two, or two players that I feel like, you know, they don't really, you know, play well together, or they're not super close. I put them to put, you know, so you can, you know, mess with that too. I mean, it gives you so many opportunities, and the boys love it. You know, they love to, even within the 2v2s afterwards, comparing who was the one individually that did even better, you know. So I think it gives you all the platforms to enhance competition, teamwork, chemistry, and, you know, they're sharing the ball with an extra person, but, you know, they're getting so many touches still. And
I love it when I call out, like, you know, all the kids' names, you know, Sam and Will versus Cal and Mason, right? And, like, you hear the kids go, yes, come on, Sam, let's go. Like, that enthusiasm, and it happens two or three times every single round where they're like, yes, I'm with this guy. Like, I'm so excited to go out and go to war with him for the next 3 or 4 minutes.
The interesting thing was that when I was coaching you, is, you know, I would call out the 2-on-2 matchups, and I'd call out your name and somebody else's name, and the other person would go, oh no,
he's just gonna kill us. Exactly. Yeah.
Nobody celebrated playing with you. I don't know why.
They sure didn't. They knew they were gonna get all I got though. the other piece that, like, I think is really helpful to mention. And this comes from your book, Andy. You talk about from animal to artist, right? The teaching of fast mental transition. The best teams are the teams that transition from offense to defense the quickest, right?
100%.
And Andy always, he loves to add, you know, some really creative, fun, flowery words. And from animal to artist is a perfect way to describe it, right? Because on defense, you've got to be stuck in. You've got to be nasty. You've got to be, you know, you've got to be animal-like, right? Beast-like. And then on offense, you've got to turn into an artist. You've got to be creative. How do you break down the opposing animal, right? And so I love the way that is. And I think the 2v2 structure allows us to teach and train from an environmental perspective, which is the best method of teaching and training, this fast mental transition, right? From the quick, creative, artistic, to the aggressive, destructive way, right? And the ability to switch between the two.
So let's get into that in terms of who's the best example of that in worldwide soccer history. Who's the guy that was most able to turn effectively from artist to animal and vice versa?
I'm going to say Zidane. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah,
that's absolutely fair. You know, and you know, in my opinion, there's a number of players. You know, back in the 60s, I'm English and I'm biased, you know, but the Ballon d'Or winner in 1966 was Bobby Charlton. He was incredibly efficient behind the ball. He wasn't Zidane. He wasn't brutally, you know, physical, but, you know, he cancelled Franz Beckenbauer out. You know, but Franz Beckenbauer was tremendous as well, and he was playing in a midfield role, and they went at it for 90 minutes in overtime in the World Cup final. They cancelled each other out because they were both so good on both sides of the ball, you know, very complete players. The other English guy that, you know, did a great job of that was Stevie Gerrard. You know, for Liverpool, he was, you know, captain fantastic, you know, and he was incredible at transferring, you know, from defence to attack and being good on both sides of the ball. The German superstar after Beckenbauer, Lothar Matthäus. Lothar Matthäus was box-to-box, you know, phenom, you know, and was incredibly good on the dirty side of the ball, as well as got forward and got a bunch of goals.
Until he got to the MLS, I went and watched him live at Arrowhead Stadium, and he was kind of like Neymar, I think, sees the MLS, like, oh, I can't wait to go there where I don't have to play as hard for as long.
Yeah. The only country that didn't really have any great box-to-box fierce fighters and battlers is Brazil. They're just too creative.
Because I don't know if you guys saw the quote from Fred from Manchester United the other day, and he kind of translated one say that we have, that, you know, they need, in Brazil, you say you have the players that carry the piano for the artist to play. So that in Brazil, that's like, so if you think of 2v2 in Brazil, you'd think of a player that will get the ball and do everything, not pass the ball, try to do everything, take the risk, and the other guy that is just going to run for him and defend for him. And because that guy, as soon as he loses the ball, it's 1v2. It's not 2v2. There's no way. So that's the one flaw, honestly, from the Brazilian culture. Because, like, honestly, growing up, and that hurts me now, I never defended, man. I just didn't. I did not care. If my team lost 7-6 and I scored 5 goals, I'd be happy. I didn't care. I would blame it on the defenders. I scored 5 goals. You guys gave up all these goals. So you do create bad habits there, because you're either the good one that people, you know, are going to give you the opportunity to not defend and, you know, try your silly stuff and try to be magical. And you have the guys that, you know, they realize they're not that good and they just run like Dunga.
Well, getting this back on track to the 2-2, that's the reason why this is so good, is 2-2 trains you to be that junkyard dog on the other side of the ball. You know, so you can't let your teammate down and say, no, you handle, you know, these two on defense.
You can in 4-4.
You know, in 4-4.
You can't even in 3-3.
As it gets to be bigger numbers on each side, you can hide more.
You definitely can.
You know, and in 2-2, there's nowhere to hide. Mm-hmm. You've got to be, and you know, this is the key, you've got to be a great first attacker and a great second attacker when you're on the creative side of the ball. But on the dirty side of the ball, you've got to be a great first defender and a great cover defender, second defender, mm-hmm. on the dirty side of the ball. You know, so, you know, you got to pressure cover constantly.
Communicate.
You know, yeah, you know, and match up. And then you got to be that animal when you've got a chance to win the ball. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not saying you should do what Zidane did in the World Cup final and headbutt a guy in the chest. But, you know, Zidane, you know, I've watched some clips, you know, just over the last few days of him defending. He was an animal. He was fierce. You know, he was scary as a defender. You know, and we see more of his creativity, you know, from when he was a professional player. You know, we don't see how frightening he was if you were playing against him and he was defending against you, because you knew you were going to get bumped, knocked, or seriously fouled if you played against Zinedine Zidane. And back in those days, you know, referees didn't call fouls like they do today.
And there weren't that many cameras. So, like, you didn't get punished afterwards. Yeah. Like, to nowadays, it's over.
So this is a good story to tell that kind of connects in with this. So at the convention, right, Andy and I presented, and then we did the field presentation on 1v1s and 2v2s. And a guy came and searched me out after one of the sessions. I can't remember which one. He was like, hey, I was in your session the other day, and I just had to come and ask. You had said in the session that growing up in the club, the system that you had was 1v1s and 2v2s only. Like, that's all you guys did all the way through. He goes, but that can't really be right, right? And I was like, oh, no, that's right. He goes, well, I mean, I'm a college coach. And at the collegiate level, like, if I were, you know, I just can't imagine a player coming to me, no matter how technical they were, and not understanding the bigger 11v11 game perspective. And I said, well, let me give you two things, right? And one is, and he was flabbergasted by my statement that that's the way we did it. And I said, well, one thing is you must remember, like, we played a lot of games 11v11. And so, like, Andy didn't sit there during those games and do anything other than encourage us and coach us on the concepts that we were playing. So if we were playing skillfully, he helped us with the tactical side of the game from the game sideline. If we weren't playing skillfully, then he focused entirely on the skillful side. But in college, I started a game in my 4 years at every single position on the field, with the exception of goalkeeper. And I was really close to playing goalkeeper once too in a spring game, right? And so I started at every position. And why was I able to play in every position? It's because we didn't do functional training and I didn't get pigeonholed into one specific position. We played 2v2s over and over and over again for 10 years. And in 2v2s, first attacker, second attacker, first defender, second defender, right? That's how the game's played out. If I'm a center forward, I'm the first attacker most often, right? And the 10 is in the cover position. And then when they rotate the ball, right, then the 10 steps up and the 9 drops back. It's the same in the center backs. It's the same at the outside mid and the right back. It's the same between the center midfielders. And so I was able to adjust and play at any position on the field at the Division I college level, because I'd spent all of my time not focusing on positions, but focusing on the roles that position has, which is first attacker, second attacker, first defender, second defender.
And just to highlight that, you gave him the answer that most people don't think and don't realize it. In America, a youth soccer player plays so many games growing up. It blows my mind. They play so many games. So during the week, you don't have to train those things because you already have so many games. It's so obvious to me. So just to give you an example, myself growing up, first time I put soccer cleats, actual cleats, I was almost 15. And then I played like 3-4 times outdoor games. Then after that, I didn't play outdoor games until I was 16. And then after that, when I actually joined the academy when I was 18, that's when I started like training more and stuff like that. So by up until I was 18 years old, I barely wore cleats. I barely trained on full fields. I barely played any full matches, 11v11. And at 18 years old, I had a professional contract with one of the top academies in Brazil. When I came to college here, I had played probably not even 10% amount of full 11v11 games as an American kid grown up playing, you know? And and I knew how to play my positions, and I knew how to understand the game from a tactical perspective, not even doing any of that growing up, since I'm 10 years old, 8 years old now, playing Heartland and learning the game, the formations, the tactical side of it. So you don't need to waste time during the week on that. You need to develop your players. That's it.
Can I read this?
Yeah.
Coaches can make a significant improvement in the tactical value of training by focusing upon multiple simultaneous 2-versus-2 small-sided games during practice. Because 2-versus-2 in a crowd is so difficult, the transfer of tactical training from 2-versus-2 small-sided games in crowded areas to the full-sided game is maximal. If players are taught and challenged to assess, compute, and utilize multiple tactical variables in a crowd, under pressure, in the clutch, they will develop many times the creative, tactical speed, and effectiveness of players trained by more conventional tactical methods. When creating the ideal psychological training environment for soccer, great coaches will need to assess the practice setup most conducive to conditioning: 1, the quick, creative, artistic; 2, the aggressive, destructive; 3, the ability to transition massively quickly between the two. What would it be like if you lived each day, each breath, as a work of art in progress? Imagine you are a masterpiece unfolding every second of every day, a work of art taking form with every breath. That's the difference that traditionally Brazil has had in world soccer. And sad to say, it's disappearing. Right, Philippe?
Mm-hmm. It's definitely disappearing.
Status quo. We got to change that status quo. It's too quick. As we begin wrapping up on this episode, I know we have a lot of legends, parents from the club that listen to the podcast because I get questions from them often. And some of these legends coaches are coaching young team or their kids play on young teams, and so they're still very much in our dribble only phase of the club, right? And so I know some parents, while they love to watch their kids do amazing things, wonder, like, how does this transition from here? Andy, do you remember the story of your 81-82s, the U19 year, U20 year, I can't remember which, in which they played in the national Final Four for USYS National Championships? They played against Blackwatch in Florida. And the coach, I can't remember who it was, but maybe South African or something, calls you up afterward because you weren't there. Chris Klein, I think, of currently the GM of the LA Galaxy, was coaching this team. And he called you up after, hey, I played against your boys in the national final. Does this story ring a bell? Do you remember this at all?
I vaguely remember it.
So I've heard this story from you several times. Okay. He calls you up and he's like, Andy, I played your boys. And I, like, we couldn't stop him. And you're like, what do you mean? He was like, Andy, like, they dribbled a lot. They were taking us on over and over again, just beating us off the dribble. And so I started double teaming everybody in the attack, in the defensive third, when they were in the attacking third. And then all of a sudden, they started doing this small combination play, overlaps in really tight spaces in and around the box, right? Wall passes, wall pass fakes, overlap fakes. No matter what we did, we couldn't stop them. We went into the game expecting them to dribble at us in the 1v1, prepared for it. And then once we doubled up on that, they started playing this gorgeous combination play. And I think that was the year that they went on and played in the final against Southern California and beat them 9-1. And so the message that I want to share with those young parents of Legends young players is, yes, it's all 1v1 and dribble first when they're young so that they can do that when they're older. But then slowly we transition by the end of high school where it's almost all 2v2 that enables them to play individually at players in the 1v1, but also combine with their teammates in this really creative way to break down defenses. Because if you can play in a 2v2 well and a 1v1 well, you're genuinely unstoppable.
And bear in mind that you know, I coached at one point in time 8 teams simultaneously in the club. And a lot of people don't understand this, but 13 of those teams won national indoor championships. Those teams won 13 national indoor championships, and everybody won one. Actually, seven, the original 7 teams that I coached won at least one each. You know, it was only the older team I took just when they were 16, 17, 18 that didn't win one. And so it transfers into winning if you train, you know, teams this way. But the point that is really, really important to make is the individuals as players got to go way further in the game than they would have done had I've trained them traditionally in functional modes, you know, and used them to win at an early age. They had plenty of success on a winning level. In fact, we had more teams that, you know, that we had 13 teams that won the championship. Yeah, we had upwards of 20 teams that went to semifinals, and we went to the finals, sorry, and lost. And we had a massive number of teams that went to, you know, the semifinals of the National Indoor Championships. We did not have one team that finished outside of the top 4 out of those teams in the country. It was a level of domination that no other club has ever enjoyed, you know, and not one team out of, you know, those 7 consecutive beginning Kansas City Legends teams finished outside of the top 4 in the nation. And remember, this is when there was no futsal. This is when the indoor boarded game was the only way to go for youth teams in the winter that couldn't get outdoors and train. And people took the indoor game really seriously. You know, the MISL was in full bloom, you know, and, you know, it was a huge game in North America back then. So, you know, those players were the kids' heroes. And, you know, and so it wasn't as though we could waltz into Cleveland and take on George and Louis Nanchoff and beat them to death. We had massive battles against, you know, those guys. You know, and, you know, it was the same in all the big cities throughout the upper Midwest and throughout the Northeast. You know, everybody played massive amount of indoor. And so, you know, it was really, really incredible that the Legends had that level of domination in that environment during that era.
Cleveland United, Cleveland International, Syracuse Blitz, Vardar, right? Like the list goes, the Chicago Blast, the list goes on and on.
These were great indoor clubs, you know, and, you know, but nobody had a record that we did. You know, we had consecutive teams every age group. You know, and our guys were always winning 1, 2, or 3 national championships.
Yep.
You know, during that era, and coming runners up and 3rd and 4th. You know, it was a fun time because, you know, while you're doing this as a coach, you question, you know, whether it's really going to work in the long run. But, you know, here we're missing the ultimate value is that these kids all became leaders in life, because when you step out of your box every practice, every game, when taking a risk, albeit a very safe risk because nobody's going to die, you know, when taking a risk in front of, you know, the spectators, you know, in front of the other players on your team, your teammates, your girlfriend as you get older, you know, taking those risks is a scary thing to do. You know, and we encourage incredible risk-taking with the ball at a player's feet. You know, and so they become incredibly brave and incredibly creative. This just doesn't stop when the kids walk off of the field, and it carries over into everything they do in life. And our alumni have had incredible success in life because we're training their mentality for life. We're not just training them to be a soccer player, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, guys, we're wrapping up this episode, but for those listening, I've got really good news. We've got a pretty consistent schedule planned out for recording moving forward. We've got in 2 weeks we'll be recording what may be the biggest topic, right, that needs to be covered, and it's the geneticism that exists within youth sports and how we're literally canceling out players because they weren't born in the right year. And not giving the kids the opportunity to develop in their own from a physical perspective to reach the heights, and we're having our pool of players at 18 that could be great based on how we approach the game. So we're going to dig into that. The plan is to record 1 to 2 podcasts monthly moving forward. So that's exciting. Andy, Philippe, great episode.
Got something more though.
One more thing, yeah?
Yeah. This is an article that was in Soccer Journal by Andy Roxburgh, who at the time was, he's a Scottish national team coach, and was on the Scottish, developmental coaching staff, and he said this: in many parts of Europe, street football has all but disappeared, but the philosophy and the mentality remains valid. The street game was player-centered, competitive, skillful, and fair. And the small-sided game with one-on-one a key element was the basic form of play. Youngsters practice for hours on tricks and on passing and shooting techniques, using a wall as their silent partner. A love of football permeated all activities, and cups and medals, extrinsic motivation, had no immediate significance for the fierce young dreamers who were dedicated to the ball and lost in the romance of the game. Now, what do we have today? You know, we don't have that. You know, we are competing with Fortnite. We are competing with lethargy. We're competing with entertainment brought into the bedroom and the home that wastes our kids' physiology, doesn't build their mentality, doesn't make them break creative leaders. You know, eats away at, you know, the things that were really good about street soccer in the past generations. And we have to turn this around. And we've created not just a unique philosophy that's proven, you know, but also a fantastic environment that accelerates this process to a massive, massive degree and turns these people into brave, creative leaders for life. But in addition, a tremendous culture of creativity and bravery that permeates everything that our players do going forward for the rest of their existence.
Yeah. Well said. Good stuff. Until next time.
See ya.
Bye-bye. Thank you.